Hello, my marketing and entrepreneur friends. Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Let's Talk Marketing podcast. I am your host, Katya Allison. So what have you gotten yourself into? Well, together we are decoding marketing to make it accessible for everyone. We're gonna cut through the BS and get down to the nitty gritty. And today I am thrilled to welcome Andrew Thomas, who is the head of marketing at Archer Meat Snacks, and a true strategic marketing leader with over 17 years of experience transforming CPG brands. He's held marketing leadership roles at powerhouse emerging CPG brands, including, get this, VP of marketing at Wild Chips, VP of brand marketing at Soylent, VP of marketing at Chicken of the Sea, and the director of marketing at PepsiCo. And at Archer, he is spearheading extensive consumer research efforts to really gain deeper insights into meat snack category segments, defining target consumers, and launching a very distinctive, ownable brand identity that's transformed Country Archer Provisions into simply Archer. Now, today we're diving deep into one of the most complex, challenges facing modern marketers, strategic rebranding. Now, CPG brands are constantly evaluating whether to refresh, rebrand, or optimize existing assets. The stakes could not be higher. Get it wrong, and you risk alienating existing customers while failing to attract new ones. Get it right, and you can unlock significant growth potential and build lasting competitive advantages. We explore the critical decision-making frameworks that really determine when rebranding is necessary versus when optimizing is sufficient. The lengthy timeline most brands underestimate, from consumer research and positioning work through design development, internal stakeholder alignment, and the complex rollout process. He shares the Archer rebranding story and how he and his team helped transform Archer from having the fifth largest market share but only 11th highest brand awareness into a distinctive brand that consumers can actually identify and remember. You're gonna hear actionable insights on creating comprehensive brand books that extend far beyond packaging, building an always-on trend spotting system, and fostering creativity with rapid growth and company constraints. Whether you're evaluating a potential rebrand, managing stakeholder alignment challenges, or even seeking frameworks for strategic brand decisions, this is the conversation that's going to provide you actionable insights you can apply immediately. So you know what to do. Grab your favorite beverage, sit back, and let's dive into it. Let's talk marketing. Andrew, welcome to the Let's Talk Marketing podcast. Super excited to have you on here today. And today we are going to be talking about just the complexities of rebranding. I've got lots of questions, so I hope you come prepared.
I'm ready.
Fantastic. Now, before we dive into it, let's have the audience get to know you a little bit. I've got my standard questions. I promise they're easy, painless. What was your first marketing role, whether it had marketing in the title or it didn't? What was your first, what you would consider, marketing role?
My first full-time job in marketing brand management was at General Mills. So I went to UCLA Anderson for business school and got recruited to go work up in Minneapolis, which it's a bit of a weather and culture shock going from LA to the Great White North. But it was great. I was excited to get my career started at General Mills. They're, you know, known as CPG boot camp. Really good training. Yes. From a brand perspective. So the first role there was hamburger helper. And I wasn't super excited about hamburger helper. I was not a consumer myself.
I was going to say, not a fan of hamburger helper. My husband's going to love this episode just for that.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things, I don't know that I had ever had it. I'm sure I had it at some point. But, you know, there's all these cool brands, like Yoplait was really hot at the time, and they had all these iconic cereal brands. And so I was a little disappointed that I got put on what I perceived as a really old and tired brand. But let me tell you, if you can work on a brand as a junior marketer that you're not a consumer of, you become such a better marketer because you learn how to actually read consumer insights, apply them to the business, because you're not thinking about it yourself as consumer. You actually have to think about it as, what are these consumers that don't relate to me? What are they looking for and what do they need? So I actually really enjoyed the brand. I was on it for 18 months and I tried all 44 varieties of hamburger, chicken, and tuna helper that were available at the time.
Does that mean that your pantry is stocked with those now or complete aversion to it?
No, it's more about I have been fortunate to move on to work on brands that are a little more on the better for you side of things.
Amazing.
Yeah. Look, Hamburger Helper solves a problem for a lot of folks, especially folks, you know, not a lot of income and big families. So it's a wonderful product for them. But yeah, the you know, the sodium count's a little higher than what I would prefer to take in.
Yeah. I would tend to agree. Now that those were your humble beginnings, tell me, where are you at now? What do you do now?
Yeah, so I am head of marketing at Archer Meat Snacks, formerly known as Country Archer Provisions, and lead all things brand marketing. So marketing communications, innovation, but I'm also really tapped into the other commercial aspects of the business, work closely with the sales team. I'm fortunate that I get to go on a lot of customer meetings. The data and analytics and category management is under me as well. So really, it's a very general management focused role for me, which I love because you get to touch all parts of the business. And candidly, I think the best marketing can only happen if you understand what's going on elsewhere in the enterprise.
That is so true. I feel like that, and then also understanding what your people are doing, you don't need to understand it enough to be the one that actually executes it day in, day out, but to understand how all of just those pieces connect with one another.
For sure.
You stated what you love about what you do, but I've got a magic wand. If I could wave it, what could I remove from your just kind of day to day? What do you not like about what you do?
Oh my gosh, this is probably a very cliche answer, but meetings. I have yet to work in a... I've yet to work in a company where it's not extremely meeting heavy. I think the challenge we find, I worked at Chicken of the Sea and it was very meeting heavy, but that was a business that was fairly well established, kind of steady state. So while annoying, I didn't feel like the meeting culture necessarily held us back. But at Archer, we are rapid growth right now. And
yeah,
whether it's launching new items or, you know, being a little more bold and experimental with our communications or social media, you need to move really, really quickly. And we're at this spot where, because we're scaling to a certain size, you want to put these processes and meetings and checks in place. You need to do it. But it also sometimes feels like, oh, we're not moving quickly enough. We're not making decisions rapidly enough.
Yeah.
We can't step back and take the time to be strategic and just do some thinking about the brand because we're always in the meetings. So that would be my number one answer.
I wish I had that magic wand.
I'm sure a lot of people
do. I know. And surprisingly, you would think that everybody would come in and say that, but probably the highest is the admin-y stuff that, you know, it takes away from kind of like the fun and the creativity of it. But
yeah.
I couldn't be right on point. Again, like if I had a magic wand, I would wave it for both of us because
yeah,
it is true. I think with marketing, you do need to have the mental space to be able to like have those big thoughts. And like you said, truly think strategically about a brand, which I think is really key to make those big moves that really make you successful. Now, I would imagine though, that you also have to really stay up to date with the things that are going on with digital marketing, content, mm-hmm, AI, you name it, with the consumers. How do you stay up to date with trends? And I don't mean like, you know, what's trending on TikTok. I think it's more of like the trends that really impact you being strategic with your brand.
Yeah, we're fortunate that our category insights manager does a good job scouring the internet, pulling in interesting articles in blogs and whatnot on things that are trending, on different ways for us to think about marketing, branding, what's going on in the category, what's going on elsewhere in the store. So that's a really good source of insights and a lot of those aha moments. I also spend probably more time than I should on LinkedIn. But I think I've done a pretty decent job curating who I follow. And it's a lot of folks, whether it's in the data science arena or other marketers or other people who talk about marketing. And that's been a great place for me to trend spot as well. So I can understand, all right, what are other brands doing? What are some of these bleeding edge technologies that we should be thinking about? You know, you mentioned AI. LinkedIn is littered with people talking about AI. What I've started to do is, you know, you click on a couple of articles and then, you know, your browser starts to feed you more stuff, and then Reddit starts to feed you more stuff. And so I've gone down a few of those rabbit holes, and sometimes it's very valuable because I end up learning about a lot of things that I wouldn't have learned about otherwise. But I wouldn't say it's necessarily a formal process. It's a little more of a pattern recognition. And if I see something popping up numerous times, then I'll track it down because I think there's a there. If it's a bit of a flash in the pan, I might look into it just out of curiosity. But there's so many things that are that flash in the pan these days. You can't track all of them down.
Yeah, this is so true. Something that I want, that I'm really curious about is, you know, you said that your category person is the one that's also bringing a lot of stuff to you. And then you, I assume, are figuring out as a team how to be creative with that. Is that accurate? Because my follow-up question to that is, how do you inspire creativity in your team when you're talking about a trend? What does that look like for you?
Yeah, what I try to do is almost detach it from the business in a way. So we have our Monday marketing like stand-up meeting where it's what's everyone's top three for the week and what's going on. And I will just lob in different topics and I'll just start going on, you know, sometimes like, thanks for coming to my TED talk. I'll just go on little rants or diatribes or go off on a topic. And what I'll do is I try to get folks to engage in it, because for me, the objective isn't to get people to think about a new idea or an implication in the moment. It's more, how do we start thinking or talking about these things on an always on basis that eventually I'm hoping your intuition and your subconscious will connect the dots. I think it's challenging to like sit in a room and be like, here's an idea. What do you guys think? I don't think the human brain works like that. You got to give it some time to process things, and then you can come back to it. I find that tends to be the most successful.
Yeah. It's, some days I feel like I just want to give like my team a day off and be like, just have it be your thinking day. Yeah. Maybe you watch something, maybe you honestly walk through the mall and look for inspiration, but this is what you're trying. This is what I kind of want you to think about or try to solve or come up with an idea about. But spend the whole day thinking about it. And wouldn't that be perfect? Right.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'll tell you one of the, I don't know if it's a better idea. We'll see, the proof's in the pudding, but one of the more interesting ideas I had in the last probably 8 to 10 months was my 10-year-old son, Connor, plays club soccer, and I live in Santa Monica, California. And he had a game down in, I think it was San Clemente. So about two and a half hours in traffic. So I had a lot of time to think. As I was driving down there, I thought, man, I should have brought some of the Archer minis with me, because they never have food at these places. And I was like, well, wait a minute. They never have food at these places. They never have food at the tournaments. There are thousands of people, kids playing soccer, parents who are hungry, siblings who are hungry. We should activate at youth sports events. It's perfect because we're grass-fed beef. We're zero sugar. We're unprocessed, real ingredients. Parents love it. Kids love it. And so we now have a youth sports activation program in Southern California, targeting club baseball and club soccer tournaments where there's thousands of people on the weekends. But I wouldn't have thought of that had I not had 2.5 hours of a car drive just to sit and, you know, marinate on that.
So moral of the story is we all just need to be in traffic.
You need to be in traffic or on a, or on an airplane. You know, it's actually a good point. When you're in a way kind of trapped or constrained and you have nowhere else to go or nothing else to do. I mean, I'm originally from Phoenix, Arizona, and I love the 6-hour drive because honestly, it's thinking time. Like, that's a great opportunity just to let your mind wander. And sometimes that's where the best ideas come from.
Oh, isn't that the truth? Now, we are going to dive into just, like I said, those complexities of rebranding. And Archer has a really great story. So I'd love it if you could just kind of walk us through the Archer rebrand story. What prompted it? Where is it at now? Like the good, the bad, the ugly. Give it to me.
Yeah, so I joined the company in October of 2022. And when I joined, our founder and CEO, Eugene Kang, he said, "Look, man, I know you've worked at some really cool companies, done some really cool marketing in the past, built some really interesting campaigns. That's not the job here. We don't have much in the way of a marketing budget. We've never really done much in the way of marketing before. You know, we've tried to do some viral things, hasn't really worked." He goes, "This job is more what I call commercially focused. I need a marketing guy who can come in and partner with the sales team at improving our insights, improving our sales decks and selling materials, making us show up in a better way in front of buyers so we appear to be true category managers, and then leading the innovation front. How do we rapidly accelerate our innovation pipeline to make sure we're gaining new distribution and providing new opportunities for the sales team?" And the good news is I'd done a lot of that before, so I was really excited by it. And you know, he said, "Look, we'll do some real marketing, hopefully, as we grow and get some more money for you." So when I came in, there weren't a ton of insights outside of syndicated data. We didn't really know our household penetration. We didn't know our brand awareness, things like repeat rate or buy rate. And so I convinced the CEO and the president and CFO to purchase Numerator data. And we started getting a great read on the panel data, understanding like where our penetration was, the total projection in terms of like category ranking, repeat rate. And then we also did a brand health tracker to see like, what's our awareness? What's our consideration? How do we stack up within the category? And the initial use for that data was building much stronger selling stories. And I got to give a huge shout out to Numerator because we received so much feedback from buyers in that first year that they hadn't really seen insights from anyone else in the category in the way that we were bringing them. And not only was it impactful from telling a really good data story, but it really helped build stronger relationships with them to say, "Hey, we're actually showing you what's good or not for the category. Selfishly, we think our brand will help improve some of those gaps." But they saw it as a true partnership. So that's what most of the data was used for initially. But then we took a look and we said, "Well, we're not really sure that we have a good positioning statement. We're not really sure that we're showing up to buyers. And you know, when they say, 'Look, I got all these other jerky brands, why do you deserve space on the shelf?' We didn't have a great answer other than, 'Hey, we're made with 100% grass-fed beef.'" And that was a great reason to believe, for sure. And I'm sorry, you can probably hear the crying baby in the background here.
He's just all on board for the grass-fed.
Yeah, he loves it. But that grass-fed beef as an RTB wasn't necessarily like an elevated positioning statement. And so we kicked off about 1,600 person consumer segmentation study that helped us identify all the consumer segments within the category. And then who are the ones that we were going to target? And then out of that, we decided, all right, this is how we're going to position ourselves. And it was generally about real ingredients for what we were calling real people. And what we meant by that was, people who aren't trying to like pursue all the TikTok trends and challenges, or, you know, they're not trying to keep up with the Kardashians. Like, they got a family, they got a job, like, yeah, they're busy and there's a lot going on, but they actually feel really, really fulfilled by that. And they would love a farm to table meal every night. That's not realistic. So they're looking for solutions that are real food made of real ingredients and a lot of different formats and usage occasions that satisfy their needs. So that was the beginning of developing that positioning statement, which, you know, we roadshowed that with our customers. They really liked it. But then we held up the existing brand identity to that positioning statement. We said, it doesn't quite align.
It doesn't match.
There's a little bit of a gap here. And so that's when we brought on a design agency, Hatch Design. And they were the ones to basically redo the brand identity. And we said, it's not just about packaging. It's about building a suite of assets that we can use everywhere. Because packaging is great, but I've been in a lot of companies where packaging becomes your brand book and the promise is very limited. And then you just cut and paste your pack everywhere in every asset. And I think a brand should be more than that. And so they also developed a really robust brand book for us, which we then used to create really nice trade show booth and assets, really nice selling materials, new PowerPoint template, new website. And it just made the brand feel bigger than it previously had. In addition to, the number one objective was, we've got to create a distinctive brand here. We really got to stand out. And a big driver of that was Numerator said we're the fifth largest meat snack brand in the country, but our awareness tracker said we had the 11th highest aided awareness. So we were doing really well. We were selling a lot of product, but people didn't know who we were. I'd run into people who are like, I've never heard of your brand. Then they pull out one of our mini sticks and I'd be like, what do you mean you've never heard of our brand?
That is the brand.
You're eating it. And they're like, oh, yeah, I guess it does say Country Archer. I just call these the minis. So as a marketer, I was like, oh, like that's not great.
Oh, yeah.
We got to close that gap. And so that was another big objective of that redesign, not only to marry up with the positioning statement, but we had to elevate the brand above grass-fed beef and minis. That's what was driving the growth, but no one was playing the brand back. And I was just looking into the future and saying, we got to build a moat around this brand so that we can continue to accelerate this growth and make sure people are coming back to us over and over again. So it was a pretty big departure from where we were. Packaging was black and white, some flavor cues and some other colors to help people shop. We went cream background, bright orange, big blue logo. It says Archer. We ditched the country. We ditched the provisions. We put like this artistic looking bull on the front. There were a lot of questions internally and from the board. Why orange? Why the bull? What are we doing here? We're growing so rapidly. Why would we make such a huge departure from where we are today? And there was a lot of selling that went along with that to get things over the finish line. So that was the selling piece was probably just as much work as the partnering with the design agency and figuring out the direction to go in the first place.
And when you're talking about selling, you mean the internal selling?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good. That's what I thought. Yeah. That's what I thought.
I mean, look, I would say there's some different groups, right? So there was the executive team I had to sell it into. So the CEO and the president and CFO. And look, the CEO, he's the founder. This brand has been his baby. So him taking a big leap like this was, you know, made him uncomfortable. The board of directors, obviously, you know, they needed to get on board. And then while we weren't selling new products to our key customers, I did go out on a roadshow and basically sold it in to all the buyers to say, hey, this is coming. Here's the rationale. Here's why. So that was the selling that had to be done.
I love that you just broke it down into just kind of those three groups. The consumer is the obvious one. I would want to know, why do we even do this? I think a lot of brands, especially now, consumer goods are rebranding. And there's this kind of like this, it falls in different categories. But one of the things that I consistently see is more of like the retro rebranding. Like it's like they're going back to a different time. And then you wonder, why do they even do that? So it's great that you included the consumer in that, but the internal as well too. So huge. I think it's really hard for people to understand that, especially as a marketer, that you're trying to get people to feel a certain way. And it doesn't mean just packaging, to your point, that brand book. I totally want to dive into that. But before that, I want to know not how you sold it. I guess it's more of, you know, I know that when I'm trying to sell anything internally, I am showing them the baseline. Here's where we're at. Mm-hmm. And then this is where we're going to go. This means success. So what was the success metric that you are bringing back to them that says, see, I told you this would work?
Yeah.
Because I'm sure that's exactly how you said it in the meeting.
Yeah, it was. Well, I anticipated that question would come. It's come a couple of times because we, we're about to launch our first national advertising campaign this coming Thursday. Which again is based off of all of this new work. And the board asked last week, actually the board meeting, they're like, well, how are we going to measure this? And I said,
yep.
What set us off on this journey was realizing there was a gap between where we ranked in sales and where we ranked in brand awareness. The number one KPI is going to be moving the dial or the chart on that aided awareness. And we've signed up with an always on brand health tracker named Tracksuit. And our goal is to constantly report out, are we moving the needle on awareness? Are we moving the needle on consideration, preference, usage, those things? But not only that, we ask some key questions around, you know, what brands do you associate with are made with grass-fed beef, are made with only real ingredients, taste good, or something my whole family would enjoy. Those questions to me are just as important as the awareness questions, because it tells me, are we delivering on the positioning that we are trying to get across to the consumer? And so we have those metrics as well. So they're not really ROI based, and they're not financially based in the way that I think a lot of people would expect. We certainly have a lot of that on a lot of our like lower funnel initiatives where we're spending money and it's easy to measure the attribution. But the whole goal was awareness. And so what I've tried to do is make sure everyone stays grounded, and that's what we're going to track. That's what we're going to keep an eye out on.
Yeah, you're not selling them leads from like packaging, which I think is a clear distinction that needs to be made. I think one of the things that consistently comes up in the interviews that I do is you have to have your goal. Like, and you have to state your goal. And then that is how you're measuring the success of anything that you're doing, any strategy that you're implementing, is you have to set the goal, and that's going to inform the success metrics from that goal.
Yeah.
Now, I do want to go back to the brand book, because I also love that you said that it's beyond packaging in a brand book. When you say that what they created for you was something that could live like in a trade show on the website, what does that look like? Are they giving you examples of what this rebrand, everything's a tongue twister, what this rebrand kind of looks like in all situations? Is that what they created for you? Or was it more just kind of like guidance for, like, I don't know, when you hire an event person?
Little column A, little column B. We certainly had some examples so that people could see how it could come to life. And certainly there's a lot of brand guidelines, like logo treatment, what not to do, what to do, how much space needs to be around it, that sort of thing. Pantone colors, typefaces, all of that. But the brand book really kicked off with a little of the strategy. You know, who's the target consumer? What's, you know, personify them and then give some data on who they are and what they're doing. And then talk about, you know, our brand strategy. So whether it's like at General Mills, it was a brand house. I've seen brand igloos at PepsiCo. There's always some sort of structure that the brand strategy falls into. We actually took our bull, and that was the framework that he sat in. Tone of voice, personality, how we're defining ourselves, so that when we go work with agency partners, they have something to work with in terms of like, well, what kind of copy should I be writing and what kind of visual should I use? But on the visual front, we tried to identify what are shapes and patterns and other colors that you may not find on the pack that still fit with the overall palette. So a good example would be, we have this bright, bold orange as this like tack coming down from the top. Well, we've done some out of home where we flood the whole thing with orange, and it's beautiful, especially if it's digital out of home. But then there's other instances where it might be like a static billboard where the orange doesn't work as a flood because it gets a little washed out in the light of day. Okay, well, then what do? Well, then we use the cream. We use some other patterns. We have some like polka dot style patterns. We got some stripes. We have some other shapes that we can apply to it so that we're not just saying, again, what's on the pack? All right, we're just going to plaster that everywhere. It just gives us some flexibility because depending on the asset, depending on what you're trying to build, not everything from the pack works. So it was really about that flexibility and versatility to give creative types more to work with.
I love that. They need like a little brand Bible to get even more creative, right? Like this jumping off point. Now that's the Archer story with, you know, that in your back pocket and also all of the experience that you have. I'm wondering, if there's a brand out there that's listening, that's like, maybe I want to rebrand, maybe I don't want to rebrand, what kind of things should we be looking at or thinking about before we even, I don't know, entertain the idea of rebranding?
Yeah. I will shamelessly borrow an idea from one of the data science guys I follow on LinkedIn. And I actually worked with him when I was at Wild Protein Chips. His name is Ethan Decker. And He works for Applied, or his company is Applied Brand Science. And he shared an exercise that I thought was really interesting. Go to Google, go to the images tab, and type in your brand or any brand. And then hit the control key, zoom out on your mouse. So you're getting this just very like 30,000 foot view of all the colors and all the shapes. And take a screenshot and then dump that in against other brands in the category. And if you can't instantaneously identify a brand based on that, it's not distinctive enough. So a good example would be Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts. If you do this exercise with each of them, with Starbucks, you get a lot of those deep greens, you get a lot of the circles of the mermaid, and then Dunkin's, it's a lot of pink and orange. If you do it in the meat snacks category, you get brands like Jack Link's, Slim Jim, Chomps. You zoom out.
All red.
You see red with Jack Link's, yellow with Slim Jim, and with Chomps, it's that stick shape, which really stands out. We did it for ourselves, and we put ourselves on the same page with Old Trapper, Old Wisconsin, and Chef's Cut. All four of them looked the same. Blacks, browns, grays, dark colors, maybe little pops of color here and there. And so I use that as an example because I think that's a really good litmus test or stress test if you're thinking about a rebrand and how far to go. Because that will tell you if you're distinctive or not. And that visual distinction, I think, is so, so important for any brand because that is going to be one of the best ways and most hardworking things you can do for your brand when people are shopping. And you don't want to just go and like throw out a bold and obnoxious color just to be bold and obnoxious. But at the same time, take a look at what other people are doing in the category. Where is there some white space? How can you do something differently? And not only that, how can you build it in a way that you can own it, not just against category competitors, but you also have to think about private label. If you become ultra successful, private label sometimes likes knocking off really successful brands. How can you build it in a way that's it's going to be hard for them to do that? So that would be the first step, is really just understanding what's the level of distinctiveness you're at today. How distinctive do you want to be, and how much do you want to close that gap? And sometimes it's going to be a big rebrand. Sometimes it's going to be tinkering at the edges or the margins to optimize a few things. But I think it's important for people, especially when they start a new job, there's always a little bit of an itch to like, I got to put my stamp on this. And I think you got to be careful. You got to say, all right, what are assets that work today? Where do we have equity that works for us? You can't just throw all that stuff out. But then the flip side is, don't be afraid to take some risks. Like if you're going to go do the damn thing, like do the damn thing. You got to be confident.
Yeah.
And you got to be reasonable about the risks that you're taking. But for people who are considering it, like you can push the envelope a little bit in terms of how you're being distinctive. Just don't lose the things that you believe are already working for your brand today.
That's a really great distinctive thing to say, is to not lose yourself in it and not get so focused on, okay, I am going to rebrand and I'm going to be bold. And I would even, everything that you've stated really, I think, identifies a rebrand from a strategic standpoint, not on a whim, which it sounds very obvious, but I've been in a lot of rooms where people are so focused on the smallest little detail where I'm like, nobody's going to notice how far apart that mark is from the word. Literally no one. They're not going to have a feeling about it. If everything else is the same, they really aren't going to have a feeling about it. So I love that you said that. In regards to like a timeline, let's use an example like Archer, because it sounds like it was, I don't want to say massive, but it was a big change. What does the timeline of a rebrand look like from like the start of it to then the launch of it, but then the how do I know it's working of it part of it? So, you know.
Yeah. It's, you know, it was a pretty lengthy timeline for us. I would say, you know, if your intuition is telling you that you need a rebrand and you go to some of those like silly little things like the Google images thing, that's great. I think the next step though is you really have to spend some time identifying, right, what problem do I need to solve here? Like defining the problem, validating that the problem exists. And that might be customer research, talking to buyers. It might be competitive research. It's definitely going to involve some consumer research. You know, for us, that consumer segmentation study and positioning work took probably 8 months. I would say if you're not spending 6 months really identifying the problem and saying like, all right, what is it we're trying to achieve here? You probably haven't done your homework, because that foundation is not only going to give you and the stakeholders the confidence that this is a project that's necessary, it's going to make your brief to whatever agency you use that much stronger. You can't just go to an agency and you're like, I think it's time for a refresh or a rebrand. I mean, they'll probably take the project, but they're creative types and they're going to go in a million different directions. The more you can give them guardrails and direction, the better work you're going to get out of them. And so that upfront work, again, 6 to 8 months, I think is probably the minimum. And then for the design process with Hatch, I would say that was probably another 6 to 7 months from the beginning to where we were like pretty close on the design, and then another 3 months to get the brand book. So, you know, you're talking, you know, nearly 2 years when all is said and done. And, you know, our design is still rolling out. So we finalized it late last year, but lead times for packaging, it's a long time. And then we have to get approvals from like the USDA and other people that have to get approvals from the FDA, and then press checks, and then the old inventory moving through the system. And so I would say, you know, when we truly kicked off the positioning work and the research was sometime in, I want to say 2023, summer of 23. And I think the new pack design will probably fully be in market, let's say February of 2026.
Yeah, to me, that's always the amazing part. And I love that you said that, because I think that there is this notion that when you rebrand, okay, you've got the logo, you've sent it off, everything should be switched over now, right? Like, you never realize where your brand lives until you have to switch it. I've been in positions where I've said, like, I don't want to put our name on anything, because God forbid we have to do this again. And then we have to go through the whole process of removing it and adjusting and all of that good stuff.
Yeah, it's tough.
It is. It's so tough. Now, you're in, obviously, the CPG space. I'd love to know just kind of how do you see consumer expectations sort of changing the future, or shaping the future, that would maybe inspire a rebrand in this space?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest trends right now is just this, I don't want to say movement towards better for you, because there's been that for a while. I think it's more, there's a groundswell of people just paying more attention, whether it's social media or various online forums. You could talk about the Make America Healthy Again movement. You could talk about the just sheer outrage against seed oils that you see in all corners of the internet. The backlash against artificial dyes, artificial sweeteners, ultra processed foods. I mean, I've seen a number of articles where people are like, well, in defense of ultra processed foods. And then like a year later, some of those same people are like, yeah, you know, I looked into it a little more, and yeah, we should probably minimize that a little bit. So the perspective and opinion on this stuff changes so rapidly.
Yeah.
I think it's important for brands not to try to always like pander to consumers and try to be something they're not. For me, it's more about transparency. Here's what we have. If you want to learn more about us, we're going to be, you know, an open book about it. We're going to try to talk to you about the things we think you care about. But for me, it's push pull, hook them with the distinctiveness and something interesting. And then when they come to your social feed or your website or wherever else, that's the opportunity to educate. And as it relates to a rebrand, I think it's really cheesy, but you have to thread the needle between being distinctive and standing out, but being accessible. Because so many people are reading labels now. I actually just read a Gallup poll on Sunday. 3 in 4 American consumers say they read labels now. The same 3 in 4 consumers said they consider their diet to be at least somewhat healthy. I think that's a little bit of an overestimation based on some other statistics that are out there. It's like, what, 80% of drivers say they're above average drivers. So humans are really bad at self-reporting these things. But I do think more and more people are attentive in terms of what's in their food. And so you have to build brand identity and brand ethos that lets them come to you rather than I think maybe were better for you was like 10 years ago. It was a little more preachy, you know, when I was on in the kombucha segment, it was very much like probiotics and live and organic acids and all these things. And like, here's why it's good for you. And I don't know that you need to bang the drum so loudly. I think people, if they're interested, they're going to come find you now. So you have to build your brand in a way that's very welcoming and opening.
Yeah, I love the way that you put that because it is absolutely true. And you also have to be authentic to yourself as a brand and not let the tail lead the dog. Is that the way that goes?
Don't let the tail wag the dog. Yep.
There you go. I always get that wrong. I don't even know why I attempted it. But the point is that you can't get swept up in what is happening from like a consumer perspective. But I love that you have pointed out, you know, people are reading labels a lot more. They are health conscious. You either are a brand that is health conscious or you're not a brand that is health conscious. You don't become health conscious all
that's
of a sudden.
Exactly so right.
That's why I'm like, okay, well, you have to also be true to yourself, but it does give you the opportunity to just kind of highlight that value prop of what like you have to offer in today's day and age. I have absolutely loved talking to you about just kind of the rebranding and learning a little bit more about Archer as well too, and the rebrand that you led there. I've got one final question just to kind of wrap up the podcast. And that is, if you knew then what you know now, what is the marketing or non-marketing advice that you would give to yourself?
The marketing advice I would give is connect with your sales team as fast as humanly possible early on in your career.
Nice.
Look at sales materials, look at selling decks, try to go on buyer meetings to the extent that you can. The moment I started doing that, it was eye-opening how hard it is to gain distribution, how hard it is to get what you want from these buyers, because they're managing sometimes multiple categories. They're certainly managing multiple brands. Their attention spans are not as long as you would like them to be. And it's just, it's a rough job for the sales folks in CPG. And I have found here at Archer, having a great relationship with the sales team has made the business so much more successful, because now I know how I can help versus some places I've worked in the past. Marketing comes up with the strategy and the recommendation and the slides. You hand it off to sales and you're like, go sell this. And then they come back and they're like, we got two items out of six. And you're like, oh, well, what happened? You're not doing your job, obviously. And that's not fair to them. So more connectivity with sales, the earlier you can do that in your marketing career, you're going to be so much stronger as a marketing professional.
Oh, that is so true. I also think that connection that you make internally is really huge. It's great for morale as well. You know, sales sees marketing, marketing sees sales, and that connection, that bonds, they are like, they know what's going on there. They know what it is that they have to combat. And I think oftentimes we as marketers can be like, all right, I need this list of things that I need to create. And then they can go to market with that. When in reality, none of that is really what helps. What they actually need is XYZ, right? Like fill in the blanks. So I love that you said to have that connection with sales. Well, that was amazing. Your story has been really inspiring and insightful. Thank you so much for coming on here.
Yeah, happy to be a part of it.
Thanks.
Let's dive into the key takeaways. So, key takeaway number one, your internal stakeholders are your make or break marketing moment. And that has never felt truer after hearing that Andrew spent just as much energy selling his rebrand internally as he did developing it. And honestly, that's a conversation that I think most of us are not having enough of. Think about it this way. You can create the most brilliant marketing strategy in the world, but if your CEO thinks it's risky, or your board questions the ROI, or your sales team doesn't understand how to use it, you've essentially built a Ferrari with no gas. Now, key insight here is that the internal marketing requires the same strategic thinking as external marketing. You need different messages for different audiences. Executives want strategic confidence. Boards want measurable KPIs. And the sales team wants tools that actually help them with buyers. So be sure to set clear expectations up front. For example, the primary success metric would be moving the needle on aided brand awareness. And how is that measured? It's measured through an always-on brand health tracker. That was one of Andrew's. It's best to treat internal alignment as seriously as customer acquisition. Create internal case studies, share progress updates, and most importantly, they deliver on the metrics that are promised. Because, you know, here's the truth. When internal stakeholders become your advocates instead of your obstacles, your marketing becomes exponentially more powerful. Your sales team starts selling the story with conviction. Your executives defend the budget and your board becomes patient with the timeline. The next time you're developing a major marketing initiative, ask yourself, who are my internal customers and how am I measuring the success for each one of them? Marinate on that one, right? Key takeaway number two, your brand book should be your creative North Star, not your creative gauge. Having done multiple rebrands, I really love this key takeaway. Companies too often use their kind of packaging as their brand book, just cutting and pasting their package everywhere. But a true brand book should give you more creative possibilities, not fewer. This connects something I see constantly in marketing. We think consistency means using exactly the same elements in exactly the same way every single time, but that's not how strong brands actually work. Nike, that's a great example. Their swoosh appears differently on a basketball shoe than on a corporate presentation, but you always know it's Nike. Now, Andrew's team created what he calls a comprehensive brand ecosystem. Yes, they had a standard logo, guidelines, and color palettes, but they also developed patterns, shapes, and visual elements that could adapt to different contexts. So when bright orange worked beautifully for digital out-of-home advertising, they used it. But when orange kind of washed out on a static billboard in the daylight, they had cream backgrounds and polka dot patterns, and that still felt distinctly Archer. The breakthrough thinking here is that your brand book should function like a creative operating system. It should provide enough strategic clarity that anyone working with your brand understands the personality and positioning while offering enough flexibility that creative teams can innovate within your framework rather than feeling like they're constrained by it. I've also seen this too many times that brands create these brand guidelines so rigid that every piece of marketing looks identical and frankly boring. Your brand book should inspire creativity. It shouldn't limit it. It should help your agency partners understand not just what your brand looks like, but how it thinks, speaks, and shows up in the world. The test that I like to use is this. If you gave your brand book to five different creative teams, would they create five variations that all feel authentically you, but look distinctively different? If not, your brand book, that might be too narrow. Another one to marinate on. My final key takeaway, the Google Images test will tell you everything about your brand's distinctiveness. Now, Andrew shared a little diagnostic tool that I found really insightful with its kind of simplicity, but its power. He said, go to Google Images, search your brand name, zoom way out so you're getting this 30,000 foot view, and take a screenshot. Then do the same for your key competitors. If you can't immediately identify your brand in that sea of colors and shapes, you have a distinctiveness problem. This connects to a broader principle I've been thinking about lately, that most of our branding decisions happen in kind of conference rooms, looking at individual elements and honestly, sometimes even obsessing over them up close. but consumers experience our brands in context and usually quickly and often while distracted. The Google Images test kind of mimics this real world experience where your brand needs to stand out in the crowd, in the crowded marketplace. And when Andrew applied this test to Archer against competitors like Old Trapper and Old Wisconsin, he discovered they all kind of looked virtually identical. Dark colors, similar typography, minimal differentiation. And that single insight justified their entire rebranding investment and guided their creative direction toward something more bold and visually distinctive. I'm sure there was more, obviously. The deeper insight here is about understanding what you actually need, whether you actually need a rebrand versus when you just need to optimize. Andrew wasn't making changes because he wanted to put his stamp on things or follow design trends. He had concrete evidence that their brand wasn't distinctive enough to build awareness. They needed to grow for the future. Now, he had more insights than just this test. But it was a good place to get started. This test works because it forces you to really evaluate your brand the way consumers actually encounter it, quickly, in context, surrounded by alternatives. It strips away all the strategic reasoning and emotional attachment and asks one simple question. Does this brand stand out? Try this test on your own brand this week. You might be surprised by what you discover, and remember Andrew's advice. You can't just throw out everything that's working, but don't be afraid to take some risks. If you're going to do the damn thing, do the damn thing. Just make sure you're doing it for the right strategic reasons, not just because you want to make your mark. Successful rebranding isn't about following your creative instincts. It's about building strategic foundations, aligning internal stakeholders, and creating distinctive brand systems that can evolve and adapt while maintaining their core identity. I hope that you listened and it sparked some new thinking about your own brand challenges, whether you're considering a rebrand or just looking to strengthen what you've already built. What did you take away from today's episode? I really, truly want to hear it. I want to give a special thank you to my podcast editor, Johnny Ike, and thanks to you for spending your time with me today. Until next time, may the conversation flow, the laughter linger, and the outlook remain optimistic, but grounded in reality. This is Katya,